Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I've been doing interviews with entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses since 2008. So a long time, over 1,000 interviews, all deeply researched. And the goal is to understand how these people have built up their businesses and why their businesses succeed in a world where so many businesses don't. And so to understand today's guest, I'd like you to imagine that you're a chief marketing officer of a publicly traded company, big responsibility. And these three guys come to you and they say, hey, trust us with all your data. Hand us your marketing data and good things will happen. If that happened to you, you'd probably be polite, but you'd say, no way, no. Meanwhile, that's what today's guests were proposing. They asked for a whole lot of data from their potential customers. They had a tiny company, nothing more, a little more than an idea, and still they got big clients, enterprise companies. And what I'm curious about is how. How did they win over these enterprise companies? How did they get them to trust this new company with so much data and actually pay for their software? The answer, if I could just kind of sum it up in this intro, is they understood these customers' pain because the guest you're about to meet today is a former CMO himself. But in this interview, we're going to dive in deep and really understand what that is. The pain, by the way, was that these marketing officers, well, they were spending a lot of money. They were watching their company spend a lot of money, and they didn't have enough control or understanding where the money was going and what was working and what wasn't. And that was the magic that helped them sell. All right. The guest is Nadeem Hossein. He is the co-founder of Bright Funnel. They provide CMOs with full visibility and control over what's impacting their revenue. We're going to find out how he built up this company. And it's all thanks to two great sponsors. The first is the company that's hosting my new business, my new website. It's called HostGator. And the second allows me to schedule meetings with people who have really busy schedules like Nadeem Hossein. It's called Acuity Schedule. Acuity Scheduling. It helps me schedule meetings. Nadeem, isn't that weird where I get your name wrong even though it's spelled right in front of me? Does that happen to you a lot?
I'm glad to know it happens to you since you're so experienced. But yeah, it certainly happens to me.
Yeah, man. You know what? Let's go back and understand this story from what happened that led to this business. You were sitting in a meeting. It was a board meeting. You were looking at charts, pointing things out. And in your head, you said what?
I remember thinking, I was actually getting ready for that board meeting. Right? It's one of my first board meetings as a CMO of this company. I'm going through my slides, sitting in the conference room by myself and thinking, man, this doesn't make sense, right? My analytical nature, my desire for truth there was a cognitive dissonance with that and what I actually had in front of me, which is showing numbers and slides that didn't present the complete picture of how our marketing investments were leading to revenue or not. So is that feeling that...
And you're working for a data company. You're working for Power Reviews, right? They're acquired by Bizarre Voice, excuse
right,
me.
Yeah.
I got to watch my pronunciation. Bizarre Voice and Bizarre Voice are two totally different things. But I feel like in a world with Google Analytics and tons of different analytic packages and tons of different tracking that this would have been a handled problem by 2012. What was missing? Why didn't you have that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we were a B2B company. We were a SaaS company, and we know now through Bright Funnel that a typical B2B company from lead to revenue takes over 500 days, and even the sales cycles are several months. So in that B2B environment, it isn't just about Google Analytics transaction, you're retargeting someone or advertising to them, and a transaction happens digitally. In a B2B world, you're typically selling to multiple people. They're going through multiple channels, online and offline. So they're seeing you at a trade show. Their executives are having dinner with you. All these things are happening. And when I started the company, those things were – it was even less of an issue. Now that's a much bigger problem. But the problem I had at the time was the data was sitting in Salesforce in my CRM system. It was sitting in my marketing automation system in Marketo. I was one of the early Marketo customers. But the two weren't being connected. So that was the first problem, was that there's different data silos that weren't being weren't being looked at and by a single system.
And you couldn't just develop that in-house, find a way to connect both those two tools and say, look, the majority of my data is in both of these two pieces of software. If I could connect it, I could get us 80% of the way there. That wouldn't have been enough.
Yeah, no, it would have been enough if what I had done was, taking the data out, put it in some kind of database or a spreadsheet and just analyze it. That's what we did. It was me, my CFO, our head of sales ops. We kind of got together and put the data into basically a spreadsheet to analyze it. And that did address part of the problem, but not the whole problem. But for me, it was, you know, as analytical as I am, as analytical as a company is, for me, it was really an emotional decision. It was a gut decision. I just realized there had to be a better way. And if I felt that way, I felt like a lot of other people would. And I started thinking about the idea and just kind of sort of a boiling the frog process where I would spend a little bit of time and more time. And before I knew it, it was a thing that I was sleeping and dreaming about. And if this happened, you know, it was an unusual situation because I was at PowerReviews. We were acquired, and there was a 3-month period where the executives, most of the executives, were going to be let go with the acquisition. It worked out well for everyone. But so 3 months where I was full time, but sort of half time, basically, you know, my transition took about a month and 2 months to think about what's next. And so by the time I left Bizarre Voice, this is sort of in September of 2012, I'd been thinking about the idea, and then I had a few more months over the holidays to really figure out what this idea was. And by the time, by the time I was ready to start this thing, I felt like I was fully committed.
By the way, I'm noticing that a lot of great ideas come from frustrating time in spreadsheets. I almost feel like if you want to find the next great idea, you should ask companies that you'd like to work with, what do you use spreadsheets for? What's the biggest spreadsheet that you have? Where do you spend the most time in spreadsheets? And that becomes a problem that needs to be fixed with better software. And so you were starting to say you're thinking about this in your off time. You were even thinking about this on your honeymoon. Where did you go on your honeymoon, and how did this invade your honeymoon?
Yeah, that's a little embarrassing. Your producer did a good job of getting that out of me. It was a really – looking back, it's crazy, but it was an interesting time, pivotal time in my life where we'd gotten married and we're on our honeymoon. We were in Mexico, in Oaxaca. So to be clear, I wasn't just spending my honeymoon working, but I had sent out some emails – doing validation research to people in my network, and they were starting to come back with responses. Here's what I think.
So before you left for the honeymoon, you emailed other chief marketing officers and you said, hey, do you have this issue? Is this a problem for you? Here's how I'm thinking about it. And while you were away, you started getting email back and started thinking about this.
That's right. And the original, the very original idea. So this would have been, I don't know, call it October, November, Q4 of 2012, basically. The original idea that emailed them out was actually going to be even bigger than what we're doing. It wasn't practical. I was looking at analytics, and I was thinking about, man, I really hate my website platform. Is there a way to reinvent the website platform and the analytics? And it turned out what everyone told me was, yeah, all the website platforms suck, but I think the analytics one is the bigger problem. And I also found that there's also lots of other startups that are already tackling a better, you know, kind of SaaS-based websites. So that wasn't something that I was as passionate about as the analytics. So I kind of broke that out based on the initial feedback and started working on BrightFunnel.
How do you have such a good network that you can reach out to them and know that you're going to get a response back to one of your ideas?
It's a good question. Part of it, you know, I'm 40 now, so I started the company as 35. Mm-hmm. And I've been in SaaS since I was 22, 23. I moved out of the Bay Area in 2000 actually. And since then I've worked in software as a service in some form. So starting a company later, if it's in a domain that you're in, gives you that luxury, I think. I think that's most of the answer. I think it's also one of my superpowers is that I can stay in touch with lots of people. I think I'm helpful to lots of people.
That's what I thought. How do you do that? What's your process for doing it? Because you do seem good at that, because that's partially why you were able to get not just good, useful feedback in the beginning, but also customers in the beginning. What was your process for, and what is it today to stay in touch with people so that you could have such a good network that when you're ready to launch, you have built-in support, built-in customers?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. The word process doesn't come into it at all. Like, it's a good question, but I think – if I looked at how I spend my time, maybe it's I do spend my time I like connecting with people. And as a result, I think that's where I invest my time.
Okay.
So I guess let me think of some examples where, you know, I'll stay in touch with former employees, for example, just because I want to know how they're doing.
Are you just shooting them an email, or is it more of a dinner? Nothing like that. Just email.
So sometimes it'll be in person, but a lot of times it's a text message or an email.
Okay.
Former bosses, you know, things like that. So I think I just like generally staying in touch. Although it's not easy because it takes time.
It really does. All right. So you got some feedback that told you this big idea should be pared down and focused on this one thing that's a big problem that no one else is handling. And you started to draw wireframes up. What were in the wireframes? How did you imagine this would be built out?
The fun thing about the earliest stages is that it can be whatever you dream up in that moment. So yeah, you know, I use online software to create these wireframes. You know, I was a marketer at the time, but I'd been a product manager before. But really the instinct came more from being a marketer and kind of dreaming up what would I want as a CMO in that board meeting. And what I knew I wanted was, you know, lead to revenue, just show the whole cycle, show everything that was involved in that.
And so how do you do that? If you're going back in time and saying, I don't have all the resources in the world, people are intentionally telling me to pare it down, what did you imagine you were going to do to create that end-to-end understanding, especially in a world where people could just meet at events and there isn't as much tracking as you would have on the web?
Yeah, so a lot of credit for that, of course, goes – so the timeline for the company was, you know, started thinking about it in, you know, end of 2012, incorporated in January 2013, and really, you know, raised the money, got the company going, which we can talk about, and really was once my my team came on board, my two co-founders, Nishith and Ranjan, that's when the dream started becoming more of a reality. So a lot of those decisions happened when they came on board. But even before that, you asked about why did I think it was possible. Actually, I didn't know it was possible. If I were to do it again, maybe I would do a bit more research to make sure that it was possible. Thankfully, we were lucky and we were able to build something that that the market wanted.
I see. You knew what it should look like. You as a chief marketing officer would want to look at this set of data, and that would help you understand whether the money you're spending actually resulted in revenue. You didn't know how it would work out. And so that's why instead of trying to figure out how to build it, you moved on to step number three, as you told our producer. Step number two was working on your honeymoon. Step number two was drawing up the wireframes. And then step number three, to actually have it built, you recruited engineers. And by recruited, you mean you went back to the people who you knew. Who are the two, or who did you recruit? It was these two co-founders, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So to your first question, I did know at a level of a product spec. I knew at a level of a bad product spec, basically, if you will. So I knew that I wanted to follow the lead all the way to revenue. And to do that, I'd have to do certain things. But exactly how, I didn't know.
What were those things that would have to happen? I have a theory on how this could get built, especially if people are putting all their data into if the sales team is putting all their data into Salesforce. I could have a sense of how you could connect all the dots and create an end-to-end understanding. But I think my idea is too simple. What was your idea for how to build it? What was your plan for how to connect it? And I know it wasn't fully thought out, and I know it wasn't as good as engineers could have put it together for you. But in your vision, how could all this data come together and actually create the clear picture you're looking for?
Yeah, good question. So I knew that, you know, the time we were doing a lot of marketing through things like webinars, email marketing, trade shows, just the usual mix of B2B campaigns. So, you know, as a B2B marketer, you'll see the sales team, you know, they close, you know, say they close Nationwide Insurance as a customer. And you're sort of scratching your head thinking, man, I swear we talked to them at a trade show, or I've seen in my systems that they've responded to some emails.
Mm-hmm.
So that data exists somewhere, and you maybe once or twice, it's just your intuition or you remember something. And if you look into the data, you know, indeed, you'll see that, yeah, we've had a bunch of interactions with this company. But what's happening is that the sales rep, when they're creating the opportunity in their CRM system, they don't attach that person. It's not malicious. They just, that person is not their key person.
Yep.
It's that person's boss. It's that person's employee. So as a result, you're not getting all the connections to the account in your systems, in your CRM system, which is often where people are looking for the results. So I knew that what I first wanted to do was to create a view of all the campaign interactions with a company, not with a person. This is back in 2013. Now, account-based marketing is a big buzzword, but back then it wasn't quite the case. But I knew that to measure the effectiveness of marketing in B2B, you're marketing to a company, not just a person. So you want to look at all the people in that company that makes it. So that's step one. Make sure that all the campaign interactions with all the right people are being taken into account. And that alone really accounts for a lot of the gap in the data. So let's say in your CRM, only one person's influence is being taken into account. Well, on average, we now know through Brightfunnel, we know that on average there are 13 people at a B2B company that are interacting, that are influenced by your marketing campaigns. Of those 13, four or five are attached to the account. They're actually people the sales rep knows about. And then there's one that's the primary. So there's all these people. And to share another stat that I think it will make this come to life, we know that on average there are 30 campaign interactions for a successful sale.
Oh, wow.
But on average, only one is being taken into account for any kind of basic marketing analytics. So it's first or last touch. We'll look at one touch. Multi-touch attribution looks at 30 touches on average. So that I knew in my gut was the case, because when you look manually through all the data, you'll see that, okay, there's lots of marketing interactions, but they're not being taken into account. So that's how I knew that there's data.
You know what? It makes sense. I kind of think about how we decided to change our help desk software. It was one person who made the decision, but another person who heard about the company and felt good about it enough that when they were talking about, should we switch over to this new software, the other person knew. They read a little bit about it. I didn't have a full understanding of this new software that we were considering, but I had a little bit of insight into it. And so I read something about them. I heard something about them. And so all of us knew and were kind of influencing the decision, even though the one decision maker would have been the person that talked to the sales team. Right. And that's what you're talking about, that a lot of people surrounding the decision maker are finding out about this business before the business gets a client.
And I'm guessing the help desk software was a significant decision for you.
Yeah.
And imagine, you know, you described that public company CMO, you know, for them, the decisions they're making are tens of millions of dollars that are going into these things. So they're significant, and oftentimes it is. I'll just take an example of maybe I'll pick a Brightfunnel customer. So this company, Nimble Storage, that's now part of HP Enterprise. Mm-hmm. So if you're selling storage systems that are, you know, let's say their deals can be in tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, it's not one IT person making that decision. There's going to be multiple people. There's never one decision maker when it's an enterprise sale.
Okay. All right. And I get why you'd want to know all that so that you can double down on the things that are working, but also understand what's not working as you're trying to get a customer. All right. Let me take a moment to talk about a sponsor, and then I want to come back and ask you about that first thing that you guys built out to get this going. The sponsor is a company called Acuity Scheduling, and I've been using it to book guests here on Mixergy for a long time. But I've noticed that software makers use Acuity Scheduling too. Often what they'll do is the first set of customers that they have, they actually won't have them buy on the website. They'll say, here's our product, and the button won't say buy now. Instead, it'll say schedule a call with the salesperson. And so by doing that, they can understand why a potential customer is interested in the product, give them a one-on-one demo, and allow themselves to learn how to improve the product while they're selling it one-on-one to the customer. That's really powerful. The other thing I've seen software vendors use with Acuity Scheduling is after somebody buys, they send them a link that says, thanks for signing up for our demo, or thanks for signing up for our software. We want to make sure that you're up and running and using this to its fullest capacity. Why don't you schedule a free one-on-one consultation with our team to help you use our software right? Now, when you're trying to schedule calls with customers, you can't go back and forth trying to find the right time. What you need is a tool that makes it easy for them to schedule with you or your team. That's where Acuity Scheduling comes in. Acuity Scheduling allows you to connect your calendar to their software, pick the days that you're available and the times that you want to have calls, and that's it. Then you get a code that you can embed on your site so that anyone who wants to book a time with you can go to your site, see the calendar on your site, and pick the time that they want to talk to you on their own, whatever's convenient for them. It's amazingly powerful. If you have multiple people who all want to be able to have a phone call, you can connect all their calendars and make those calendars available to your customers. If you want to talk to your people, if you want to talk to your customers, there's no better software. And I could say it as a guy who's used everything. Well, just about. I can't imagine that there's one piece of software around this that I haven't tried. This is the best because it's robust and everyone on your team can use it and it really works. It's beautiful. Go sign up at acuityscheduling.com/mixergy. If you really want people to talk to you, go talk to Acuity Scheduling. Here's the URL. When you go to acuityscheduling.com/mixergy, you're going to get 45 days free to use it, and they're going to give you a one-on-one session with their professional schedulers so that you can understand how to fully utilize this and bring it to your company and grow your sales. Check out acuityscheduling.com/mixergy. Really powerful software and elegantly simple to use. All right. So the first thing that you built, Nadeem, was this API connection. Talk to me about what that means. You were telling I'm reading directly from my notes here from your conversation with our producer. First thing that you did, first customer, API connection. This meant that you actually didn't build the app. Talk to me about what you mean by that.
Yes. So when we think about, you know, when did the system go live, the way we thought about it, the three of the co-founders, looking backwards, it's, you know, it's really the first time someone gave us their data. That's really when it became live. And then that was, I think it was around June 1st of 2013 or thereabouts when we're building our alpha application. And so we pulled the data into our system. And we had some application built, some very basics that we were doing, but we first got the data and then we built around it. That's how I describe it. Because until you have someone's data and you have a sense of what it looks like, it's hard to build a data application.
Actually, so first you say, give me all your data. Then I'm going to figure out how to make sense of this data and get you what you're looking for. So before you even can offer a solution, before you had the software written, you needed them to trust you with their data.
That's right.
How did you get that kind of trust? How did you get a customer to do that?
So I think it's a good question. I don't have a great answer to that. I think the likely answer is that it was a combination of things. One is their problem was big enough. So, you know, if someone promises you a miracle cure, but you're really sick, maybe you'll listen to them. Mm-hmm. I think it was an element of that the pain was strong, right? It wasn't just like, give me a vitamin so I can maybe feel better someday. It was really, man, I'm a CMO. I want to prove my value. I'm going to board meetings, you know, I'm making decisions with no visibility. Okay, this sounds like it's got a shot. That's I think part one. I think part two was sort of more was the entrepreneur and the team, right? They saw, okay, this guy, Nadeem, has been a marketer. He's describing the problem the way I feel it, the way I felt it. You know, it's not like some college kid in their garage, although, you know, that mm-hmm. certainly would work too. And it's not just this one business guy, you know, which is frankly what it was. It's also two really, really strong, you know, engineers that are co-founders. So I think that combination, those two things probably helped. Okay. I think the third thing would be, you know, in 2013, there's already some acceptance of, you know, applications built on top of CRM data and marketing, but primarily CRM data. So it wasn't like we were the first company out there trying to take your data and analyze it. And the last thing would be the person giving us access might not be the person, maybe the consciousness of the data they're giving might not have been top of mind for them, right? And that's sort of maybe that's the scariest one.
I see. You're saying that they didn't realize that this was that they were giving you so much data.
Right. I mean, today, you know, today we're doing business with, you know, European companies with all sorts of privacy. So we have all sorts of hoops we go through. But obviously day one, it was just three guys in an office space, you know, give us access to your data. And your data is basically everything that's in your CRM, all your bookings data.
Yeah. I'm worried about that. I'm still surprised that they would give you that kind of data. You know what? Even when good friends of mine create Gmail plugins that give me all kinds of power, I refuse to install it because I don't want to give them my whole Gmail account data. I don't want to give them that kind of access. I worry about it. I'm amazed that you were able to get customers to say yes in the beginning.
Yeah, to be honest, it was never an issue. It sort of surprised me a little bit, but at no point has the issue of you're getting my data been an objection. It just doesn't come up.
Wow. And it's because your reputation, all three of you, It's because of the people. It's because the size of the problem, huge problem. They need a solution. And because the early clients were coming to you from your network, from people who knew you, from people who trusted you, like Nimble Storage, who you mentioned, I think earlier, was an introduction from an investor, not yours, but someone who you'd known. What was in it for the investor for making that kind of introduction?
So in that case, it was just their reputation, goodwill. They wanted to put money in, or they potentially wanted to put money in. So it was maintaining some a relationship. It's sort of the example of.
So this is their way to say, hey, you know what? We believe in you enough that we're going to turn on this company to you. And at the same time, we're going to get some feedback and see, does Nimble Software actually like the software that you guys are building? Is the solution actually effective? Is that what it was?
Exactly right. And in that case, it wasn't till this is maybe an example of, I didn't know the initial buyer at Nimble Storage was Dan. I didn't know Dan except through the investor, Peter. But once he introduced me, he introduced me at the very beginning when we were starting. We didn't become a customer till probably a year later. The exact time frames I don't remember, but I stayed in touch for a while. It took not just the investor making the introduction to this sizable. They had just gone public, so they're already a public company. But it also took a buyer on the other end who himself had vision. All right, that person who was my buyer was the sixth employee at Nimble Storage. So they were an entrepreneur themselves. So they'd gone through that journey. They know that it takes early customers to have faith in a startup to create a big company.
Let's talk about some of the funding that you got. I'm looking on AngelList, and it looks like you guys had the first round of funding was 2013 seed round, $760,000. Is that right?
Yeah. So the exact the first close. So I'll give you sort of maybe a bit of the inside baseball. So we raised in total, we raised angel money of I think $650,000. That was over the course of. That money came in from May 2013 to September 2013. But what let us get into business was about $250,000 in May 2013. And I'd spent February through beginning of May raising that money, had an initial close, and then throughout the summer we took on a bit more money. But at that point I wasn't raising full time. I was taking the money in as it came.
I see. And how did you get Ryan Holmes, the founder of Hootsuite, as an investor?
That's a good question. So Ryan, after Power Reviews was acquired, when an acquisition happens, a lot of the management team gets a lot of credit for it, rightly or wrongly. And so people knew that, I was part of a company that was acquired. Mm-hmm. They knew that I might be looking for a job. And so I got introduced to Ryan, I forget through whom. And we had a couple of meetings because he was looking for a VP of marketing. That was the context. I think this was back in 2012 before he had hired a VP of marketing. And we had a couple of meetings and I really liked him. I think he liked me, but in our fourth meeting, I told him, hey, look, I don't want to, I don't want to lead you on. I actually decided I don't want to take a job. I want to start a company.
I see.
And here's what I want to start. And I actually had the wireframes with me in a folder printed out. And when I told him I want to start a company, of course, in my stomach, I'm thinking like, I'm not really sure. Like I'm putting myself out there and maybe I look like a fool telling a successful CEO I'm going to do this thing. But, it took him about 30 seconds. He might remember it differently, but we talked to him. He's like, yeah, I have this problem myself. If you started, I would angel invest in your company. Maybe we'll become an early customer, which actually they became. Later on. So that's kind of that was a good sign that people really had this problem, that it didn't take a lot of back and forth for someone to say, you know what, this is a problem and you're the guy that should go do this.
I'm looking at the people who invested. There are a handful of angel investors, all of them C-level people at companies that are kind of connected to the problem that you're dealing with. Like the chief revenue officer of Marketo, whose software you're going to connect with. The CEO, former CEO of DocuSign, the CTO of Kana Software, Exact Target CMO, just goes on like that. That's essentially what it was. The kinds of people who you wanted as clients or who you wanted to partner up with, you talked to them about your product. They liked it enough that they invested, kind of like Ryan. It seems like that's what it was, right?
Exactly right. And I think, we raised money from angels. That was really the only option I had, right? Taking 25, 50K checks. The biggest ones were $100,000 checks. There's only like two of those. So if someone came and gave me a $3 million check, I would take it, believe me. But one of the nice things about raising from angels was that it continued the process of validation. So, you know, raising money from 20, 30 angels or 20, 25 angels, most of whom were pretty knowledgeable about it, you know, the opposite would be worse, right? If the only people that gave me money were, you know, uncles and dentists, that would be a bad sign unless you're starting a software selling to dentists. In this case, I'm selling to CMOs and people like them. And so the ones that got it were, the more knowledgeable someone was, the more excited they got, which was mostly good. It meant that it was something real. Of course, it meant that investors, regular investors who are not experts potentially, took a little bit more educating. So getting these early folks, early angels on board became a much easier way to convince the later investors to tell them, look, these are the smartest people in the world about this area. They're all putting money in. So don't just take my word for it.
Right.
Talk to these guys, talk to their early customers, and then it just gave it a lot of validation.
Seems to have happened fast. 3 months, you told our producer. How did it feel to you at the time?
Oh, it felt like forever. It was.
I'm surprised. As a guy who's used to sales cycles that last over a year, why did 3 months feel like forever?
You know, it was just, I put myself out there where I had my daughter Stella, who's now almost 4 in August. She was, well, that tells you she was born in August of 2013. So I knew I was going to be a dad, and you know, I just gotten married at the end of 2012. So my wife, in hindsight, I realized how supportive she was at the time. Of course, I was like, man, I've got to do this. You got to let me do it. And her answer was very reasonable. It's like, look, yeah, do what you got to do, but as long as you're not unemployed when the baby comes, right? And, you know, unemployed can have a broad definition, but I took it as I've got to draw some kind of nominal salary.
Yeah. So
once we had that, you know, I was working on the company for, you know, 6-7 months, but once we had that first round of funding, the three of us were paying ourselves a nominal salary. And so I wasn't unemployed when Stella was born. And so that was one of the reasons I felt really, I felt stressed. I mean, there's really no other word for it. You know, you don't want to be a guy in a power with a PowerPoint sitting in a coffee shop. That's not a company, right? That's just a,
not when you have your child. It really puts a lot of pressure on you to finally, like, not finally, but to get things right so that you can, so you know who you are in the world. Do you feel that at all?
Absolutely. It's definitely, a lot of it is self-identity. It's not just, you know, it's not just the money. It's also like, am I wasting my time? Right.
I mean, yeah.
You know, I started a company later in my career, having just come off of a successful exit where I was a part of the management team. So the logical thing to do would have been to try to go somewhere like a Hootsuite or a big bigger company, even a public company, and be a CMO of a bigger company. But that just wasn't, that's not what at the
what
time.
What would it like to have a new baby as you have a new company that demands insane amount of time? They both do.
It's one of the, I actually got advice from a couple people, but one of them was the founder of Marketo, and he's like, you know what, at the very beginning, it's not so bad, because at the very beginning, new babies take a lot of time, but they're taking time from the mom, and the mom's doing all the work, right, for the most part, breastfeeding and taking care of the baby. First few months are actually fairly quiet. It's just sleep deprivation, things like that, and you can do it at home. You know, it's, babies take odd hours, right? Startups during the daytime. You have a lot of flexibility. It takes time to get flexibility. So in the beginning, it wasn't that bad. It's really, I think, frankly, it's now, it's as your kids get a little bit older, you know, year and a half, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, that's kind of when they take more time from you, I think.
I find that the first few months were really tough because of the odd schedule and the wake up in the middle of the night and so on. But you're right that now you've got to go and pick them up from school or be there for them on the weekends. And they know it if you're not fully present on the weekends, right?
Exactly. In the beginning, if you have I had a startup that really didn't, it was nothing. It was like, you know, three guys in a garage type thing. So at that time, the work wasn't demanding in the sense of schedule, in the sense of customer commitments. It was very flexible. So that flexibility as an entrepreneur was helpful being a new dad.
All right, I want to come back and ask you about your burn rate, because I'm surprised that you didn't have more, and you said that there's one thing that you did that kept you from burning a lot of capital, and then understand how the business grew after you got it up and running. But first, I have to tell everyone about this the hosting service that we use to host our company. It's called HostGator, and they're a sponsor of ours. And I've got to tell you, Nadim, HostGator was a sponsor of ours for a long time, and then we paused them because I heard from our members that maybe we shouldn't have them as sponsors because they weren't the best. And so I started looking into it. I said, you know what? Let's just pause the ads. Let's see how they do. And I talked to every single person who had any experience with them and was part of our community and said, how was HostGator for you? And what I found was that HostGator was a really great platform if you were using it with the cheap plan and all you needed was a cheap plan, or if you had the high-end plan and you needed a high-end plan. But if you're someone who needed the high-end plan and went for their cheapest plan, you were dissatisfied. So I've realized that I need to make that clear to people. HostGator starts out with the cheapest plans out there, the ones that can get you up and running for just a few bucks a month. But if you're growing, they'll grow with you. Just remember to go to them and just keep upping the service that you get. And so, Nadim, when we started a new business, one catering to people who want to start bot agencies, I said, who do we sign up for? It's got to be HostGator. And we went to HostGator. And as the business was growing, and it's only a few months, I said, we need to keep upping it so that we have a hosting company that can deal with our growth. And it was really growing fast. And that's why I'm really proud to have HostGator back on here. I checked them out with our customers to make sure, with our listeners, to make sure when they signed up, they had a good experience with HostGator. And I also used it for myself over the last 2 months on our new business, watched what happened when we were pounding it with a lot of traffic, watched what happened when we were experimenting with lots of different plugins, and the service stayed up. I don't think it's been down at all. All because of HostGator. I can now say, as someone who's investigated them, as someone who's talked to our community about them, as someone who's used them, HostGator is a fan-frickin-tastic hosting company. And I urge you, if you're looking to sign up for a hosting company, to sign up for HostGator. The only difference I'll make now is coming back and doing more ads for them is this. If your business is growing and you really want to keep upping the service that you get from them, meaning one that can handle more traffic, one that gives you more exclusivity, investigate their higher level plans. Start out with the cheapest one because it's really good. But as your business gets growing and you want more services, understand that they will grow with you. And that means they go from a shared server to a dedicated server to even WordPress managed hosting, where you say, I'm running a WordPress site. You guys at HostGator deal with it for me. They'll do it all for you. All you have to do is go to hostgator.com/mixergy. You're going to get 50% off their already low prices, which means prices start at $3.48 a month. But also when you sign up through Mixergy, if you have issues, you can always contact me, and there's me standing behind your relationship with HostGator. I can't like do everything for you guys, but the fact that I then forward it on to someone at HostGator, if there's ever an issue or for any sponsor, means you get a level of support that you wouldn't get ordinarily. And that's what I do to make sure that our sponsors are really good. I keep encouraging anyone who uses my sponsor to let me know, good, bad, or otherwise, let me know what your experience is. Overwhelmingly positive experiences from HostGator, and I'm proud to have them on as a sponsor. Go check them out. If you need web hosting, hostgator.com/mixergy. All right, coming back, and thanks, Nadim, for sticking with me through the ads. Let's talk about what you did to keep your burn from being so high as you were getting going.
Sure. So as your burn rate is related to, you know, how much money you raise as well. So until now, we've raised $9 million. Just to give listeners some context, we raised $650,000 in angel money. And then we raised a $2.5 or $2.4 million seed round.
That's in 2014.
That's right. So 2013, we raised about $500,000. Then, just call it that. I think about $500,000 in 2013, $2.5 in 2014, and then $6 million in 2015. And so that in total, just shy of $9 million in funding raised. And our Series A was the last round we did. And this year, 2017, we'll go raise the Series B. But so far, so from a capital efficiency, I think we were pretty capital efficient.
You're saying, hey, part of it was when we got started, we couldn't really raise that much money. And this was high-end enterprise-level software. We needed a lot of money. And since we didn't, we had to really be conservative. You also say, hey, we were very measured about it. What do you mean by measured about the way you spent money? How did you deal with expenses that other people might not?
So I think a lot of successful founders are frugal. And I don't think it's just purely a matter of you need to make the money last. I think thinking about the trade-offs, right? Startups are impossible. They should be impossible, right? No one should be able to take a company from zero to create millions in revenue. That's just so hard to do. And to do the impossible, you have to really manage your resources carefully. And then as you become successful, that mentality can actually become an obstacle. So you've got to be careful not to let that be an obstacle. And it isn't a matter of, even in the early days, if I took a customer out, I took them out for lunch. Certainly I spent money to make money, no question. But we were careful. And I'll give you examples. We were careful in things of making sure everyone paid from the beginning, right? Our initial customers, the initial API connections happened in, call it June, July, August of 2013. Mm-hmm. We got some sort of product standing up sometime in October, November. As soon as they had some kind of product that would have some value, they were already paying us.
I see.
Now, that was hard to do. That's what we did. Whether it was the right thing or the wrong thing, that's what I felt comfortable with. Some of the money certainly helped. Getting a $50,000 upfront payment when you're three people does help you manage your burn rate. That was one. And then as we hired salespeople, even to this day, the vast majority of our deals are annual upfront payments. So that helps us be more capital efficient than we otherwise might be. There are other things that cause us to need to spend money, right? It is more of an enterprise sale, so you need salespeople, they need a ramp. There's other elements of the business model that are typical for enterprise software, but that do cost a little bit more capital. Certainly on bad days, I wish I was selling something that was $100 a month and, you just buy it online, right? But, it just wasn't the business model that we picked.
It seems so tough to have sales cycles that last over a year. It means over a year of effort before you actually get to close the sale. And along the way, there's so many ups and downs, so many times when you potentially lose the customer.
That's right. So our sales cycles are typically a couple of months.
They are, okay.
The sales cycle doesn't last a couple of years, but that's where the marketing comes in, right? You're nurturing them through your marketing efforts for over a year.
That's what I meant. So you're saying that from the time that they understand that you exist in the world to the time that you close a sale, it's over a year.
That's
once
right.
Once they talk to a salesperson, it's a couple of months, 3 months.
Exactly. And as a startup, that does make it hard because in the beginning, let's say the answer is not no, the answer is I'm not ready. Well, you need business as a startup, so the fact that you're not ready doesn't really help you, but you have to keep nurturing them in some way, or you've got to stay on their mind in some level. It might take a year, and that happened to us, right? Some of our best customers, so Cloudera is a customer, they just went public recently, but they were a customer of ours, they were a private company, and we have met them 2 years before, or a year before they became a customer, we had met them. And they had the problem a year before they bought the software. And they said, we have the problem, but we're not going to buy your software, which is crushing as an entrepreneur. I mean, inside you're like, oh, man, why aren't you buying it now? And at the time, they're like, we're going to try to build it ourselves. As awesome a company as there is as far as big data and analytics. They have data scientists. They have in-house ways of analyzing data. Far more than I had at Power Reviews. And so they thought, why don't we take a shot at doing it ourselves and seeing if that solves the problem? A year after that, they said, we could solve parts of the problem, but it's taking too much time and it's not worth it. These guys have built a product, why don't we use theirs? And within that year, of course, our product got better as well. So when we reconnected, it was a much easier decision for them to say, let's use BrightFunnel instead of trying to go it alone.
What advice would you give someone who's listening to us who is selling to enterprise customers for whom that simple software strategy you talked about earlier of charging $100 or less, letting people buying online, that wouldn't work? What advice would you give to people who are selling to enterprise?
I would say it's sales is everything, right? I think most founders are product founders. So I was a product founder. I wasn't an engineer, but I really cared about the product and making this thing come to life. I had the pain, and I enjoy sales. I still do, but it's very easy not to do enough of it. So I would say it's something I think I did right for the most part, but I would have done even more of it if I look backwards. What I mean by that is just spend time getting money in the door, getting customers in the door. And it's not just about the money, the burn rate, but it's really about in the beginning when you have nothing, your customer usage is the thing that keeps you alive. So what I didn't know as a first-time founder was that the scarce resource is not just capital, but it's customer feedback. When you're at our size today, we have plenty of customer feedback. We're, you know, sort of, everyone knows us, I think, in our target market. But when you're starting out, it's no one's heard of you. You know, why do you exist? And for someone to care enough to give you feedback is a hard thing, unless you have enough people using you. So A, spend time getting those early customers, and do get people that you think are going to be good customers, that good in terms of giving you feedback. That's very, very
how to get those early customers.
I think it's any means necessary, right? I mean, everyone has different superpowers. For me, I had, you know, I've never been a wallflower. I've always enjoyed cold emailing or calling or networking to get a meeting. I've done that since I was in college, right?
You're just constantly like emailing, cold emailing, asking networks, asking people, asking investors, asking your network to make introductions. And then you get in a in-person meeting with a potential customer. What do you do at that point? Where does your superpower take you there?
I think for the most part, it's getting me there is the superpower. But at that point, it's really about, then it's your product and your company, and there's more at stake at that point. But you know, if you get those meetings and no one wants to use it, then maybe you're talking to the wrong people or you know, your product's wrong. But at that point, my ask was to try to figure out, do you have the problem? You know, can I solve it? Here's what we're doing.
I see. First, here's the problem as I see it. Then do you even have this problem? And then will you let me solve it? Was it useful to even hear no from people who said, no, I won't let you solve it?
Sure, absolutely. How? That's part of the feedback. It was useful in understanding, you know, why was it, what was their objection? And sometimes they don't voice it, right? Especially if they're not a customer, if they're a prospect, they might not tell you your baby's ugly. But some of them will. Some of them will be more explicit. And those non-customers are very valuable. So they might say, you know what? I had one person tell me, actually, it was Bizarre Voice. Ironically, I knew I was friendly enough with the people at Bizarre Voice that had bought PowerViews. They said, you know what? This is interesting, but let me show you what we built. And they showed me their Excel-based thing that's running on automated scripts. And it was amazing. It was pretty amazing what they built in Excel. But no one else could do that besides them, besides like 1% of people that had an analyst spending half their time or full time doing this. So it was useful to see that, okay, it was a good insight that later they could become a customer. They weren't ready at that point because they had a better product than I could build. And it was also
and now you knew what to shoot for, that here's what they spent all this time and invested all this money to create. Now I know what we need to do to win their business because this is the level of result that they're looking for. And people like
sunk cost of they'd built this thing that worked to give them some of the answers, but no one else was going to go do that.
No,
right?
I see.
In fact, I showed another company that hey, go build this. They'd say, okay, no, thank you. And you know what today we realized, you know, the original vision of the company never changed, but it becomes clear over time is what I discovered. So today we realized that. We're solving a set of problems for these bigger companies that, you know, they have 50, 100, 200 marketers. So Cloudera, I mentioned, has roughly 50 marketers globally. Concur and other customers, about 200, give or take. And when you have more than, say, 10 people using our product, then it's not just about getting the answer in a spreadsheet. It's about the user actually has to want to use the product. They're a marketer. They're not an analyst. They're not a number cruncher by nature for the most part. They want to be creative. They want to, you know, launch that next campaign or host that next party. So that interface has to serve that particular marketer's persona. And in marketing, it's a very heterogeneous environment. It's not like in sales where Salesforce, you know, we want to be the Salesforce of marketing in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. Salesforce is the Salesforce of sales. And it's very homogenous, whether you're selling a big product or a small product, you're selling something and you're closing a deal. There's a sales cycle.
Right.
Marketing is not like that. There's advertising, there's creative, there's content. There's all sorts of people in marketing that are dealing with the customer for a long period of time. So because of that, the user interface has to really meet the marketer where they are, whatever their role may be. So that's an insight we didn't have in the first 2 years. We didn't have that insight until some of the early customers like a Cloudera became bigger. And we saw that in their usage. And so that spirit of, you asked about advice, I'd say that spirit of customer feedback and curiosity, you have to continue that no matter how big you get. And it gets harder to be curious as you get bigger because, you know, you have something that works and you want to maintain that, but how do you keep making it better as a company?
You know what? A random thought came to me as you were saying that. We're talking about sales and marketing being obviously two different things, but it always reminds me of the very first business class I took as an undergrad at NYU. And the first question out of the teacher's mouth was, So can someone tell me what marketing is? This was a marketing class. And so I said, I'm a know-it-all. I read the Wall Street Journal before I even got here. I stand up and I say, marketing is sales. And he said, no. And then I heard the difference, right? Marketing is, I don't even know, how would you describe marketing versus sales?
That's a good question. So in B2B, marketing is, so my belief is that marketing is eating sales, right? I think with more automation, with internet, with mobile, with all these big, massive secular trends, we are making it possible for automation, which is marketing, to take more and more of the customer relationship. It doesn't mean salespeople are going to go obsolete. It just means that, if I can use an analogy, in the old world, you know, sales was sort of the Civil War soldier with a musket and, you know, just getting, you know, blown up to smithereens, and yeah. Very inefficient, right? Today, you know, let's take a Navy SEAL. It's still very, very risky, but they've got, you know, satellites in the sky, they've got intelligence, they've got, you know, all sorts of technology behind them, and that's marketing. If sales is a Navy SEAL, marketing is everything else that's making that Navy SEAL able to do their job.
So marketing might be my blog post and my email and the ad that I had and the fact that I did some PR somewhere. Sales is the salesperson finally coming in and saying, you have some questions, I'll answer the questions, and then maybe at the end of the call, at the end of a few weeks of conversations, the salesperson closes it. And what you're saying is today that salesperson has a lot of information because of the marketing that happens before. And I even think of our operation. We talked about help desk software. When you email us, even the help desk people know what you clicked on, which emails, what you've bought from us in the past. And so they're ready to respond. And that's how salespeople are prepared also. They know what you've clicked on. They know what you've done. And by the way, the first freaking sentence in that marketing book was marketing is not sales. So he knew immediately I did not read that book. All right, let's close it out by talking about customer churn. That was an issue for you, and you took it personally when there was customer churn, meaning people are leaving you. Why did you take it personally, and what do you do to avoid churn?
So as far as taking it personally, I mean, I don't mean it as I was mad at them. I was more mad at myself.
Yeah.
I mean, it is personal. Right?
I know. I hate it. I feel like someone rejected me. Someone just doesn't like me.
That's right. That's what it felt like. And, you know, you want to, as an entrepreneur, you want to do everything right, and you have that intention. Let's say I had the intention, but you lose a customer. That sucks. And what it felt like was, I joke that it felt like I have a tattoo of every churned customer on my arm. And thankfully it's not a full sleeve yet. It's just a couple, but it is that level of pain. And the reason it felt painful was, you know, because of that, how much I tried, and there were, you know, it was my baby, the product and the company. So that's why it felt personal.
Why did they churn? What could you do to fix it for them?
So that's maybe that's the advice I would give to myself is, you actually, if you want to build a big company or anything sizable, you actually want some churn, because until you have churn, you don't know anything, right? It's impossible that every customer that bought your product is your ideal customer. And if you don't know your ideal customer, you're not going to be efficient to grow the company. You're not going to scale well. So the sooner you figure out who your real customer is, the better. Now, you don't want to be fooling yourself and saying that every customer that churns was actually a bad customer. That's sort of a cop-out. But a few of them were good customers, but your product wasn't ready. Others were just bad customers. And either way, you want to learn about that.
Yeah.
So that's why you want, and the other thing, the other reason you want some churn is you want to make your service better, right? So it's impossible that you got it right, exactly right the first time. So it's just going to happen. So I would tell myself in hindsight to maybe take it a little bit less personally. I don't know that any good entrepreneur would, though. I think I could tell myself that, but if I didn't take it personally, I probably would be a bad entrepreneur.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. So it's kind of
– you know what? I never asked you. The company's about 5 years old. What kind of revenues are you guys doing?
So we're in the millions of revenues, single digit millions of revenues. That's as much as I can share.
Okay.
And so, you know, we are, it's about 4 years old. So we basically launched the company. We started building the product in mid 2013. So, you know, I've been working on it 5 years, but the company, really the product is about 4.5 years from the first line of code, if you will. And we didn't launch the beta product till January of 2014. So basically we've been in market for that long. And 2015 is really when we actually had a commercial product we felt like we could charge. It was worth charging what we're charging for it, if you will. So the sales element of it has been happening for, you know, more like 2.5, 3 years.
All right. Well, congratulations on doing so well. And I know that recently you've changed your position. When we close out by, actually, I keep saying when we close out with one more. What's the new role that you've taken on at the company?
So I've become executive chairman of the company. So my realization was we're now scaling. Operationally, the company is, it's a real company, which is exciting. There's a lot more to do. We've got to go scale our sales and marketing. We've got to continue to extend the product. And so we've hired a CEO who's full-time, came in from LinkedIn Marketing Solutions, a great guy, Chris. And I'm focused as a full-time at a board level. So I'm executive chairman, which, you know, I can joke that's the same title that Eric Schmidt has and maybe Larry Ellison or someone. I'm not quite doing the same thing as those guys are. But my job is to be a bit more external, so spend my time on the strategic partnerships, you know, starting to work with agencies, for example. We've never had any agency relationships. Mm. Starting that process. Now we're big enough that they could care about us, and it just takes time. And with the credibility of a founder, I can do that. So if you're an agency listening to it, definitely reach out. We'd love to partner, or some of the more other software companies we can partner with, things like that, strategy, et cetera. So spending a bit more time at the strategy and board level and a bit away from the day-to-day operations, which is exciting for me. It's giving other people a chance to step up and me a chance to sort of broaden my thinking about the company.
All right. The website is brightfunnel.com. Great domain. Great URL. Thank you so much for doing this. And I want to thank my two sponsors also for supporting this program. The first is the company that hosts our new business's website and has been doing a great job of it. It's called HostGator. Check them out at hostgator.com/Mixergy. And the second is a software that allows me to book meetings with people who are insanely busy because it makes it easy for them to schedule with me. You should use it when you want to talk to your customers and potential customers. Check them out at acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy. acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy. Nadeem, thanks so much and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. If anyone wants to follow me on Twitter, it's Nadeem Hussain, at Nadeem Hussain. That's the best way to get in touch. And thank you for doing what you're doing. This is a great service.
Love it. Thanks, man. Thanks. Bye, everyone.